This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision making from two Canadians. We're hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore, portfolio managers at PWL Capital.
Welcome to episode 254, and we have a returning guest this week. David Blanchett joined us, Ben, and what a conversation. And it was varied. Like, you poured over what? At least four big topics in preparation for this. The big part of the conversation was on regret in portfolio construction, which is super fascinating. Then we went on to retirement tools, retirement planning, compensation models in the industry, risk exposures and portfolios, and then fascinating work he's done on home country bias. Like, what a round trip.
Yep. We covered a lot of ground. I basically just went and read all of the research that he's published since last time he was on, and he's done a lot. And the first two big topics on regret and portfolio construction, which is fascinating. Like, he's basically built a portfolio optimization model that includes a term for regret. So given that somebody is concerned about regretting missing out, FOMO basically, it's basically a FOMO portfolio model, which is kind of funny to think about. But it just as a thought experiment, it's fascinating. Like, even it doesn't necessarily inform, like, it's not a normative model. It's not going to tell you you should invest in this regret asset optimally, but it's kind of descriptive of how would we explain why people want to invest in regret assets? And if they wanted to do that, what's the optimal way to approach it? So that's, I think, kind of how I would explain his model there. But that part of the discussion was fascinating. But his stuff on optimal retirement income is also incredible. So we spent a lot of time there as well. And the last two topics were shorter because it was just kind of quick questions on a couple of papers, but fascinating empirical findings on foreign revenues and how they explain foreign revenues as opposed to domicile, and how that explains returns, and then how advisor channel influences the advice that they give to their clients. That's a lot of ground to cover in a approximately hour conversation.
Yeah.
But David was on it.
He was on it. He showed up. He brought his game. And so David is currently head of retirement research for PGIM, which is formerly the Prudential Investment Management, which is the asset management arm of Prudential Financial. So he's in their DC Solutions group, where he develops research and solutions to help improve retirement outcomes. When he was with us last time on episode 137, a couple of years ago, he was a head of retirement research for Morningstar. He's currently an adjunct professor of wealth management at the American College of Financial Services and was formerly a member of the executive committee for the Defined Contribution Institutional Investment Association and the Employee Retirement Income Security Act Advisory Council. Published over 100 papers in all sorts of incredible journals. He has a BS in Finance and Economics from the University of Kansas and an MS in Financial Services from the American College of Financial Services, an MBA from the University of Chicago Booth School, and a PhD in Personal Financial Planning from Texas Tech University.
Incredible background.
Incredible background, incredible energy, very articulate. Fantastic episode. Anything else to add, Ben?
Nope. It's a nice wide-ranging discussion with technical content, but I think also very accessible and practical content, which is, that's something that David came back to a few times through this conversation, is like, how do you make this type of modeling more practical for how people actually are and what's actually useful to people? So yeah, great conversation. Let's go ahead to the episode.
All right. Here's our conversation with PGIM's David Blanchett.
David Blanchett, welcome back to the Rational Reminder Podcast.
Great to be back.
All right. I want to start on your new paper on regret, which is just a fascinating way to think about portfolio optimization. Can you talk about the difference between risk aversion and regret aversion?
So risk in traditional like portfolio optimization routines is like standard deviation or downside risk, right? It's volatility or losing money. And I think we can all kind of agree that that's pretty uniform. People don't like losing money. Now, people have different perspectives on what losing money would do to them. So like, you might be really conservative and I might be really aggressive, so I'm okay being a more aggressive portfolio. What that totally ignores, though, is how you might feel about certain assets doing really well. So risk is focused on kind of like losing money. Regret, or like FOMO would be like a fun word to use, is focused on this notion that how you experience an outcome could really affect you. So maybe you didn't lose money, but maybe not making money like really negatively affects you, and it creates all this emotional pain. And it's obviously a different type of pain than losing money, But if you think about like risk as a continuum, maybe I would have been willing to have a little bit more risk in my portfolio if it would reduce regret at some point down the line. So all these behavioral things here too, like we've seen this, investors abandon diversified portfolios during speculative bubbles because they're missing out on this next wave. You know, could allocating to assets, even in small portions, actually increase their wealth because it keeps them diversified over longer time periods because they're less prone to like investing speculatively.
That's crazy, man. It's kind of like the Robert Merton intertemporal asset pricing where people care about standard deviation, but they also care about covariance with other stuff. You're kind of saying they care about standard deviation, but they also care about regret minimization.
Well, so what's interesting is that I think people internalize, like risk is, I think, pretty standard. I think that most all investors experience risk. Okay. I think regret is very different in that a lot of folks won't experience regret. Like I don't experience regret almost at all ever. I just don't care. Like I make good choices, I move on. And even if you're going to experience regret, it'll be for different assets to different degrees. Right. So like what really got me thinking about this is cryptocurrencies. It's like, you know, just from my perspective, there's different beliefs out there. Like, you know, it doesn't make sense as an investment. But could it actually make sense to still own it? And I'm like, well, how could you define the decision to own this asset as being rational? Well, you could if not owning it would cause you a lot of emotional distress similar to risk. And so I think like the key difference between risk and regret is that risk is pretty consistent across all investors. Regret is very investor specific in terms of like what they'd have regret for, how much it bothers them, just everything else.
What is driving that regret in investing?
This is going to shock your listeners, but people aren't utility maximizing robots across all time periods and all times. We're people, right? I mean, you know, we go back to the tulip mania. You look at real estate bubbles. You look at like people are prone to greed, right? And when things start doing well, I think investors respond differently to having missed out. Could this have changed my life? Oh my gosh, I could have bought Bitcoin at a dollar and now it's worth, I don't know, 25,000, whatever it is. And so I think that the emotional response that's triggered when we see other things do well that we don't own, it's very personal, it's very emotional. But you know, I even make the point in the research that I would say even like institutional asset managers to some extent could suffer from regret, right? You know, you could see this, for example, in the performance of like the US stock market, the S&P 500. Like you might hate large cap stocks as like a tactical asset manager, okay? But if you don't own them and they do really well, that could be really bad for you from like a benchmarking perspective. So even if it's a little bit less efficient, based upon your expectations, it could actually make sense to still own it to the extent it allows your clients to realize the value of your process through a full cycle, right? So like to me, like the key here is not just saying that, oh, okay, you could have less wealth. You have to acknowledge that individuals bail out over certain time periods, and that's where they really get burned. And so trying to do things to keep them engaged over longer time periods, acknowledging regret, acknowledging FOMO, could actually help them create more wealth over the long term.
Interesting. So is that kind of the main idea with the research is to suggest how much of a regret asset you should have in a portfolio to avoid bad behavior? Is that the general idea?
Yeah. I mean, so like I have like this like super formal objective function where you can actually do optimization routines. And there's been some other research out there on regret previously. I would say like two issues of the existing approaches is that usually you only focus on one asset. So like you could include one regret benchmark in your analysis. And that, like, you know, you could care about 80 different things. But I think that's what's even more important is assumptions around normality, right? So previously, research is like, for example, adjusted a covariance matrix. So then that's cool. But like, what if you want to do like lotteries? Like, you know, are things that have really non-normal payoffs? You can't really include those if you use traditional covariance. You know, the actual approach that I came up with, it allows you to kind of do anything you want. It's effectively, you can do a scenario, you can use historical returns, but it would allow someone who really actually wants to model this to figure out, well, how much should I allocate to an asset given return expectations, whatever else, along with the rest of my portfolio, given kind of coefficients and aversion factors for different things.
How have you modeled regret in your research?
So more formally, right? So think about the return distribution, okay? Risk, as we think about it traditionally, would just be like the left part of the distribution. It's the portfolio going down. That's a deviation. You could just pick a MAR, a minimum acceptable return, and that's your risk target, okay? Regret, though, there's actually lots of ways you could do it. But I think like how I did it in the piece and in the optimization so far is you have, you know, some combination of or individual risk assets. So like you could just call it a volatile asset, an efficient asset, you call it cryptocurrencies. And you compare the performance of your portfolio to that asset. Okay. You can do it at certain thresholds, like only if the performance asset exceeds 50%. There's lots of ways you can do it. But the key is looking at your return distribution and how it does versus something else. right? So if you think about the way this works then is if I, even if I'm like somewhat risk adverse, but I just have a massive amount of regret, just an absolutely ton of regret, you could see moving the entire portfolio or most of the portfolio into the asset that I would feel regret about. Now, that would result in an inefficient portfolio. But the key is as you kind of acknowledge, hey, there's other things that drive this definition of efficiency, it moves the weights towards those assets. And there's some really interesting kind of ideas here. One is that, you know, as you increase the volatility of an asset, you actually increase its weight on average when you incorporate regret. Right. And that is the exact opposite of traditional mean variance optimization, because if you make something riskier, it makes it less attractive. Well, if it becomes riskier, you can still lose everything, but you can get, you know, 3 or 5 or 10x if it does well. And so the assumptions you use, your model, I think what it does is it gives individuals a reason to think about owning things that you wouldn't ever say you should do if you use traditional portfolio routines, just because people are humans. And I think advisors have to manage it. I'm sure that you all have to manage this with your clients. You have to have these conversations, right, with clients that, you know, want to own, again, it would be Bitcoin or other things. Like, how do you all deal with those conversations when you have clients that really want to own something that you don't think is efficient, but they're going to do it no matter what?
Yeah. Well, we do it through a conversation. We've never had a utility function. We've never had a way to model it, but basically what you've done, I think, where just conversationally, where you tell ask the client, think about in the outcome, the good outcome that you're imagining, how great are you going to feel if it goes 1,000x or whatever? But on the other hand, if it goes to zero, how are you going to feel? And then make a decision based on the range of emotional outcomes. But I think you've kind of taken that and quantified it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't know that too many folks are actually going to perform the portfolio optimization routine that I outline in the paper. But I think to me, what I was just trying to figure out is how do you rationalize, just again, for me, owning speculative volatile assets? Well, this does that. Like this really suggests that, you know, if you're someone that really cares about what something would do, I don't know, NFTs or just whatever, carve out a small part of the portfolio and do that to satiate you from, you know, cashing out everything and going all in into that if you miss out too much.
What are the asset pricing implications if people do think about portfolio optimization this way?
I don't know, right? I mean, one, if you think about like there's other interesting frameworks that exist, there's behavioral portfolio theory, there's like the popularity stuff. I mean, and if you even look at like people's expectations, they're radically different even on more traditional assets like large cap stocks and bonds. They're even more different on more esoteric assets. I think it's the esoteric ones that are most prone to regret, the most speculative assets. And so right, you already have massive differences in expectations around cryptocurrencies and just everything else. So I don't think it's much because the, you know, this is like we're talking about like mega cap stocks here. We're talking about things that have very small market caps. And I think that it won't even necessarily change the total portion of wealth that goes into these assets. Because I think from my perspective, you'd have a lot of investors owning a little bit than maybe a few investors owning a lot. So I don't know that there's much there beyond the existing kind of frameworks and acknowledging that people are behavioral, irrational creatures to varying degrees.
Interesting. Okay. Now, how do you decide what the regret benchmark should be?
Earlier to your point, it's like it takes a conversation, right? So to me, the hard part here is that everyone is so different, right? The things that they think they might respond to aren't going to be the things that they do. So you almost could create like a regret portfolio. You could like literally look at like Google Trend searches and be like, hey, these are like the 10 things that are persistently interesting. I'm going to, you know, but the idea, I think that advisors from this for a long time, you let a client open up a Robinhood account and they can day trade their heart's content with, you know, a fraction of their portfolio because it gives them that kind of high, like that gambling high, but it doesn't imperil them accomplishing their financial goals. This is just kind of saying, hey, if you believe this Blanchett guy, like this actually gives you justification for doing that because of the emotional response you could have to certain things doing well that you don't own.
Okay, Blanchett guy, how does this portfolio optimization routine around regret affect the asset allocation of the portfolio?
So it depends, like the best answer ever, right? It depends. I think the one thing, so I mean, a few effects. So one is if you have two assets and one is marginally more inefficient than the other, right? If you do any kind of like resampling, you'll still have a higher weight to the one that is more efficient. But like, let's just say that the one that is a little bit less efficient, and right now, like that's like large cap stocks, just for example. So like large cap stocks, okay? Let's say that you have capital market assumptions, CMAs, and everything's fantastic for small cap and emerging markets, international, and large cap looks terrible. Okay, well, like large cap is the thing that people focus on the most. You know, like people still quote the Dow Jones. It's the weirdest index ever, right? You know, there's the S&P, there's Russell. Like, so by not owning large cap, you kind of create this potential for regret where if it does well, why didn't you do well? But if it does poorly, like no one really cares. So to me, it's acknowledging one, like what are the differences in expectations around commonly used assets? Like that's the first one. And the second one is maybe before you were investing the full $1 million in your diversified portfolio, now it's only 950 or 900. I don't know the right number. And they have 100 or some number to do with whatever they want. They're going to invest speculatively. And in theory, like that portfolio won't do as well. That isn't necessarily true, right? I mean, you know, I've been hating on Bitcoin for a long time. If you bought Bitcoin a long time, you'd have tons of money. And so while I might not think it's efficient, no one knows what's going to happen. And so, you know, it's not just money that's going to get lit on fire. It's just money that's going to be very volatile, right? And in theory, if you can own multiple volatile assets that have some diversification qualities, it isn't necessarily that bad for the portfolio to begin with. But it is kind of by definition, again, assuming your capital returns are reasonable, correct, you know, making the portfolio a little bit more inefficient versus a well-diversified multi-asset portfolio.
Yeah, it's one of the other things I thought about reading your stuff on this is that it's hard enough to do a mean variance optimization, right? Because we can't predict the future. And this would be even harder, I can only imagine, to truly optimize ex ante.
Well, it is. And so like I think this requires a bit more resampling, right? So running multiple iterations of an outcome and seeing how things compare. So, you know, that's why like it is more complicated. Again, I don't expect a lot of advisors to build tools that can do this. Because again, like what do you assume is the return of this speculative asset? What is the vault? Like no one knows. Like, come on. Like, how do you even pick numbers here? And so like inevitably, what you'll likely have with here are assets that have, it doesn't matter what the return is, they're going to have this astronomical vol, right? And so a relatively low geometric return. And so you probably, it wouldn't work well in a more traditional setting, but it does. You kind of say, hey, like, let's acknowledge the fact you're not a robot and think about how you might feel if this does well.
How does the effect of optimizing over regret change depending on risk aversion?
So it has different effects, right? So again, there's this thing, well, like, what is the regret asset? So like, what are you not owning? And so in theory, it could be like a really safe asset or really aggressive, but like people don't regret not owning cash. Like I don't picture that being like the thing that, oh, I could have bought cash and I could have made 5%. It's like, oh, I could have bought like Bitcoin or whatever. And you know, it went up 10 times. And so I think, you know, when I think about this in real life, you would have bought or will buy assets that are really, really aggressive, right? They have a high volatility, okay? So if you're a really conservative investor, it could actually like increase your expected return based upon your assumptions around, you know, the regret assets. It's going to increase your risk. If you're a really aggressive investor, it could reduce your return a little bit just based upon the return assumptions, but also increase the risk. So like by definition, risk is going to increase because you're allocating more of your wealth to assets that have high volatility, but the return expectation should be that it's going to go down, but it could be like a bimodal distribution, right? Where in most instances it's zero, but in some instances you hold it long enough, it makes you tons of money.
Are there other asset characteristics that might drive optimal allocation to regret assets?
Probably, right? I mean, so I think the one thing that I didn't really dig into is just all the different ways you can think about when someone regrets not owning something, right? So again, I made this point earlier, but it's like, is it when it goes up 20%, 30%, 40%? Does it have to go up more than another asset? So like, do I only really care about it if it's up more than the S&P? And so I think that like, there's lots of ways to go down this path. What's really important though, is acknowledging like the non-normality aspect of this. Like, so like lotteries are a really good example. Academics like hate lotteries or like, it's just this terrible payoff. But like, I mean, it's kind of interesting if you just buy a small ticket because like, if you're just a normal person, like how else are you going to buy a yacht one of these days? Well, if you win the lottery, you can buy a yacht. And so again, like I'm not suggesting people go out and buy lottery tickets, but I think what we have to acknowledge when we're kind of managing someone's wealth is that there's lots of different ways to think about outcomes. And yes, they're trying to accomplish a financial goal, but you know, if you invest them in this like really efficient and incredibly boring portfolio, does it negatively affect like their desire to save? Like saving in 401ks in the US is so boring, right? Like, you know, oh God, I'm going to save 10% a year. Well, hey, do you want to invest in Bitcoin? Yes. Are you willing to kind of set some money aside in an account to start out? Yes. And so I think that there's actually ways that if you talk about this stuff, you can actually increase expected wealth on average because you play more into the exciting aspect of investing versus just kind of super dull, professionally managed portfolios that invest in 15 ETFs or whatever else.
So interesting. Instead of the single asset, super boring portfolio being good because it controls behavior, in this framework, it's not good because it allows for regret, which may lead to bad future behavior.
So one example of an implication here that I've seen firsthand is participant behaviors in 401k plans during periods of market volatility, right? So you have door A and door B. You're defaulted into a target date fund where you hold this like black box thing. And door B is your default into this like multi-asset portfolio that you can see like you hold like 15 funds. Without a doubt, individuals are more likely to kind of pull the ripcord, pull parachute when they're in this single multi-asset fund because they don't understand what they actually own in their portfolio, right? So I think that to the extent that you can demonstrate to someone that they have a diversified portfolio, there's no additional cost, it can actually kind of encourage better decision-making over time because people don't understand how diversification works, what, you know, like a global market portfolio is. And having those individual slices, I think actually there are pretty clear behavioral benefits there because it just better lets someone understand that, hey, I don't own one thing, I own thousands of things.
Wow. Yeah, that's counterintuitive. That was a paper you did, right? On the 401k behavior?
Yeah. So looking at like how people responded to market volatility, and just to be clear, like for the most part, people don't. I think one of the best things that's happened to 401k plans, DC plans, is moving away from self-direction. So you're getting people into target date funds. I mean, by definition, they're not perfect investments. You can't have everyone in a five-year age band have the same portfolio. But if we go back to where we were, 100 million Americans building portfolios, that's a terrible idea. That is like the worst idea ever. So I think that, you know, moving people to these structures that do it for them is really good, but there are ways that I think to kind of like tweak it on the margin to help them make better choices over time.
Could you solve that through disaggregated reporting of the underlying assets instead of actually splitting them up?
So there's services that build portfolios using core menus. And there's actually plans that have what are called custom target date funds where they're using the same funds on the core menu to build target date fund with. So you can look at it different ways. But like across the board, what you see is when someone is defaulted, so defaulting is by definition passive choice, you're not actively engaging. Like, you know, they're the ones who are the least likely to make a trade regardless because they just don't do anything. But the more holdings they have in their portfolio, the less likely they are to make a change when things go wrong, when you control for like being defaulted, demographics and all that.
You had a paper on that too, right? Where you looked at what was there is some people didn't make a positive change if they'd been defaulted in or something like that.
Okay, so like, yeah, I've got, you know, all this fun stuff. So it's the unique role that defaults have on participant decision-making. So like one thing that's interesting is how things like the employer matching level and the default level interact, right? So if you have a plan that has an employer match and you have default contributions, you know, what does that do for participant behaviors? Like which one matters more? And, you know, if you know behavioral finance, the result's not shocking. Like what really matters is the default savings rate. Right? Like whatever the default is, people just do that. And there's really interesting effects around things like if you have a low default rate and a high employer savings rate in a plan, that's actually like a tax on poor people because they're not very sophisticated. Like they don't understand that you need to save more to get the match. They're just going to go with the default. And so what you actually see is having higher defaults, without a doubt, benefit individuals who earn less, who are less sophisticated on average, because they're more prone to just do whatever the default is. Other cool things too, where like as you have higher default savings rates, you have higher acceptance of target date funds. And that's because you're not asking someone to do something that they wouldn't do otherwise. You know, because if the default's like 3%, you're gonna be like, nah, I've heard I gotta save 10%. So if I can't trust the default savings rate, I can't trust the default investment. When you have higher default savings rates, you actually encourage more individuals to just go with target date funds. So there's tons of evidence now. So like the problem though, to be clear, this was a full data set, but like most plans weren't going over 6%. And 6%, in my opinion, is still pretty low. And so what I hope to do at some point, it could take 5 years, is to do a refresh of the data when we have a lot more plans doing 8%, 10%, 12% as default investment savings rates in 401k plans. So it's pretty clear like 3 versus 6, 6 is a no-brainer, but we already kind of knew that. I think like the next step is when we move beyond 6 to 8, 10, and 12, how at some point things could drop off or change.
Absolutely fascinating. So it's well known that investors chase attention-grabbing assets. So what should financial advisors, like should we be catering to or moderating in some way the risk of regret?
You know, I think my opinion on this has probably changed over time. I feel like a decade ago, I'd have been like, quiet you. No, you're not allowed to do that, right? Because I could be like, oh, you know, we don't know what's gonna happen. But I think that what that doesn't acknowledge is how people will respond. And what it can mean for that relationship if that asset does well. Like, let's call it a coin flip. Let's call it less than a coin flip. There's like a 30% chance or 20% chance it does well. And then the entire time, the person's like, why did I listen to that advisor? Like, that was terrible advice, right? And so I think, to me, it's just acknowledging these behavioral aspects of investing. I mean, if I were a client, I'd be like, I don't care about cryptocurrency. I just want to have a good portfolio. And I think that's how a lot of people are. Other folks would be like, you know, I follow this stuff. I love reading about it. And so I think having the conversation, engaging with them and saying, hey, okay, this is important to you. Just to be clear, like, I think it belongs in a well-managed portfolio given the uncertainty. But I think, you know, no one knows what's going to happen. And it wouldn't kill you to allocate a portion of your assets to it. We have to acknowledge it could go to zero. But if that makes you more comfortable saving, investing, and doing things, I think it totally makes sense. And I think that's a different perspective than even I would have had 10 years ago, because I wouldn't have acknowledged the more behavioral aspect of investing as I'm increasingly kind of focused on.
Does it then make it harder for the investors to choose a financial advisor? Because then you're kind of doing some sort of regret selection mechanism for the advice you'll be given?
I mean, from my perspective, it's giving the investor permission to invest themselves in these things that they're passionate about. So I think that there's still areas for advisors to add a lot of value, you know, to understand these assets, understand if someone's going to buy them, where and how they should buy them, checking in with the investor. So I think if anything, it gives the advisor a unique way to have a more meaningful conversation about investing. And what we've seen usually happen here is these don't tend to go well. Like, you know, a lot of these speculative assets tend to do well for a while and then they tend to crash. And so I think that you don't want someone to fail. But having had that conversation with an investor, setting expectations, limiting their overall allocation to it, and then if the person experiences, you know, that eventual decline, that's created kind of a really good way for them to have that relationship. And maybe it does, maybe it takes off, okay? And you can even say, hey, you know, I never would have thought this would happen, but this is why you hold a little bit up, right? I wouldn't necessarily recommend allocating more. But I think what it does is it gives a way to kind of have a more meaningful conversation about investing than just like, hey, this is the market portfolio, it's mean rate efficient, all that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We've had a lot of conversations like that over the last 10 or so years where we'd explain, listen, this is a highly speculative asset. The rational thing to do would be not allocated to it, like the, you know, mean variance approach or similar. But then we've given the explanation of the range of regret outcomes if this thing does go to which the moon or if it goes to zero. And we've seen people make decisions on that basis with that framework. And I think overall, it's been a pretty good decision-making outcome. Even if the financial outcome was, you know, the speculative asset did tank, I think people going into it with their eyes open, kind of like the way you've explained in your framework, is pretty successful. Do you agree, Cameron? You've observed the same kind of thing as me.
For sure. Absolutely.
Instead of just saying, you know, no, don't invest in this, it doesn't make sense. It's like, here's what a rational model would predict, or here's what a normative model would predict. Here's why you might not do that in real life.
But it also depends on who's driving the choice of that asset. Like, are people looking for the advisor to help them choose the regret asset or not? Yeah, they're choosing on their own because they have a passion about crypto or a particular stock or something else. But you're saying, David, to go and do it on their own, like come with that choice, then acknowledge the regret decision around that asset choice. As opposed to saying, Ben, give me a long shot investment.
That's why I wanted to ask David, which we did, how do you choose a regret benchmark? Because I don't think we can define it. I think we can't go to clients and say, you might regret not holding, you know, Ethereum.
No, and I wouldn't recommend, like, you know, walking, hey, there's like 20 things you could own. Which of these do you want to? I think it is more self-awareness of the investor. Like, you know, like which things, you know, I mean, investing in diversified multi-asset portfolios is super, super fun. But like, are there other things that you're passionate about that you think have potential that maybe we're not going to own? I mean, yes, if it's individual stocks, we're going to own those, but a small portion, you know, maybe they think that biotech is the next greatest thing. And so then as opposed to crypto, it's biotech stocks or it's something else. And I think that it takes their preferences to know that. I mean, you know, what you obviously don't want to get blamed for is not owning whatever does well. But as long as you kind of check that box, like, hey, like, do you have any things that you're really passionate about that you think could do well that you want to trade more frequently in? And if so, then this is how you do it. Again, to me, it's just versus just saying, no, we don't do that. We don't recommend it. Own this portfolio and just leave me alone.
Do you think the source of a lot of that regret is kind of story driven? Like my friend was invested in this or heard about this at a certain event or geographically, perhaps, like if you're from a part of the country, it might be more oil and gas dominated or tech dominated or crypto dominated or whatever it might be.
Well, I mean, hindsight's 20/20. I mean, like people don't talk about losing money in things, right? You know, like it's only the good stocks they bought or the, you know, they got in early on crypto or all these things. I think that that's just the nature of people, right? I mean, people don't tend to talk up their failures, they talk up their successes. And so, and you see this when you have assets that have done well. Like when Bitcoin, the Super Bowl, a year and 2-3 months ago, like that was the peak, like the floating QR code. I mean, you have this awareness in the media, I think, and that's where it becomes a lot more salient. And so, I mean, and I don't know that there's always just one thing when this happens. I think it's just certain circles, you know, to your point, you could live in an area that's got, you know, a lot of folks that do oil and gas. And so that's the thing. There could be rental properties. There could be lots of different things. And obviously some are easier to own than others. Like, you know, I mean, like rental properties, like that is a whole different ballgame. Like, I think that's not what I'm thinking about in this. It really is more things that are kind of marketable type securities or investments that are, they're easier to buy and sell and transact.
Yeah. Just on the having people around you doing something that, that might increase regret. The closeness to a counterfactual is one of the biggest drivers of feelings of regret. So if instead of thinking about an asset that you might buy, if you're thinking about an asset like employer stock that you already own and you're making the decision to sell it as opposed to how much to sell, as opposed to the decision to buy, that's like as close as it gets to having owned that asset. Yeah. In that for regret framework, that's even more interesting.
I don't have as much as I used to, but I had tons of people that asked me about cryptocurrencies and they bought them and they made all this money and there's all the social media stuff now. So I think like the closeness and connectivity is a lot more real than it used to be. You know, if in the past, you go back decades, you know, you'd only really hear about people making tons of money in the newspaper or at a random party. That didn't seem very real, but it, when it's your connections, your circle that's talking about their winners, all their winners, and you didn't get it, it just becomes, I think it's becoming more of an issue because it's so much easier for individuals to communicate what they're doing to their closest friends instantly, right? We didn't have this as easily decades ago. We do now. And it's likely only going to get worse. I mean, I think that we're going to become more connected. And so you just need to be, I think, more aware of, I mean, FOMO is a thing, right? This is related to FOMO. And this is just one aspect of FOMO that's for investing, not just other social experiences.
Crazy. FOMO is a thing. And one of the other big ones is social comparison. That's another big behavioral driver of, or happiness driver. All your friends get wealthy buying Bitcoin or whatever, then you might feel terrible. Okay. That discussion of regret was fascinating. Can we move on to your other recent stuff on optimal retirement income strategies?
Sure.
Excellent. What are the downsides of modeling the retirement liability as a single constant inflation adjusted amount?
So I'm going to get geeky here again. So
yep, do it.
Love it.
You know, I'm going to write a piece soon. The 1990s want their key assumptions back. Okay. And the point is like, so all the early research in retirement was like 1990s, like Bill Bengen was 92 or 94 and like, you know, more stuff. But like, if you look at the tools advisors are using and the assumptions, they're mostly identical. And I don't know if everyone knows this, but we've gotten a bit more powerful computers up there now than we used to have, you know, 30 years ago. But like the key assumptions in our financial plans are mostly the same, which to me is a bit disappointing. Okay. And so, you know, for example, most research and the vast majority of planning tools assume that the retirement income goal is effectively a static number that like increases every year by inflation, right? It's a single value. Well, like that's nuts, right? I mean, like in reality, like people's expenditures have different levels of elasticity or flexibility. I'm going to make changes as the portfolio evolves. And incorporating these rules into a projection can really affect the outcome. And I've been talking about this for, I don't know, a decade. Advisors always say, well, David, that's what I do. I go in and I work with clients every year to tell them what they can afford to spend. And I'm like, well, that's spectacular. But here's the thing. If you account for a dynamic process in a model, it changes your advice today than just doing it over time, right? So if you can model the fact that you're going to make changes as changes are warranted, it actually changes what you should have done 10 years ago. To me, the goal behind the research was just in the Financial Analyst Journal is to kind of lay out a framework that I think better addresses reality in any kind of financial plan. I totally acknowledge it's like a hot mess of assumptions of like 50 years and all this stuff, but you can get radically different outputs, I think, using just more realistic assumptions around things like outcomes metrics, around like spending and stuff like that.
Why is it important to understand the composition of retiree spending as opposed to having that single spending number?
So like utility is how economists quantify preferences. I think about utility. So Monte Carlo is a model that incorporates randomness, right? That's how most advisors today, when they do a financial plan, that's what it is. So the utility function in a Monte Carlo analysis that uses static projections and success rates, it's binary. It's ones and zeros. Okay. So did I accomplish my goal? I get a one or I get a zero. I get a one, I get a zero. So the problem with that is that a dollar short is a zero. Okay. There's no notion there of if I fail, how did I fail, right? But in reality, And this is where things get a bit more complicated, is that if I don't achieve my quote unquote goal, let's call it $100,000, what I can't do is going to have a huge effect on how I feel, right? If I can't pay for my house, my healthcare, my food, I'm going to be really, really angry. Okay. Like if I have to wait a year to buy a new car, like I'm upset, but I'm not really angry. And so I think understanding the composition of the spending goal, and then if you don't accomplish it where you are, is just important. Because let's say that all of your essential expenditures are covered from guaranteed income. You've got a defined benefit plan, you've got a public pension, whatever. Well, like then a shortfall like might not be that big of a deal. Like I can just adjust if I need to. But let's say that you have very little of your needs or essential expenses covered with guaranteed income, then all of a sudden a shortfall is more painful. I think if you don't really understand what you want to spend money on and what the flexibility is, and you do a traditional projection, you're going to get an output that might not reflect how you would actually feel across the different outcomes.
And when you look empirically, what portion of retiree expenditure is elastic versus inelastic?
70-ish is the average, but there's like massive differences. So you can look at this using like expenditure data. I've done a bunch of surveys, you know, and like one of the surveys I asked all these people, like the main expenditure groups in the consumer price index in the US, it's like a consumption stuff, you know, like in food at home, food away from home, transportation, you know, an individual's willingness to cut back on those expenditures, right? No one wants to cut back on healthcare for the most part, but like there's some people will cut back on healthcare, but will not cut back on leisure activities like vacations. That is so important to them, right? And so to me, like the key with this is that yes, there's are clear relationships where on average individuals who spend more tend to spend more and more on things that aren't essential or necessary. There's more choice there, but everyone is different. To me, like you can generalize and I could say 70%, but what I would say more is it takes kind of understanding what you spend money on, what you derive utility satisfaction from, and then figuring out how to do that in a financial way.
Can you talk a little bit more about the distribution? What drives the differences empirically? Like you mentioned, higher expenses tend to be more variable. What else is there in there?
So like, again, this is so hard to measure. And I've done it like two ways. One is just to observe expenditures. You can do this in, there's this, it's called the Health and Retirement Study. You can look at how individual expenditures, you know, towards not only like what they are, but then how they evolve over time. And you can ask them questions about what they perceive to be inflexible or flexible. I think to me here, just like the number one key is just moving away from a single static number to anything that somehow incorporates this notion that, okay, half of what I'm spending money on, I would not want to change. The other half I'm willing to. And then seeing how that maps out over time. Because the biggest thing here is that a lot of Americans, a lot of retirees have a lot of their needs covered from guaranteed income. And so it dramatically changes what you should be doing in terms of investing their portfolio and funding retirement, because it's the wants or the more flexible expenses that are that the portfolio is funding. And that's just not how we model retirement. Like a lot of the models that people use for retirement are from like the pension space, like LDI. LDI is built in this framework of like a hard liability. Like pension plans, they have to make that payment every month, every year, hard stop. That is not going to change. Okay. People though are very different, right? So when I think about building portfolios for retirees, it's more like liability aware investing, where like, you know, the liability's there. You have to acknowledge the flexibility. The moment you introduce flexibility into the process, it just really changes anyone's perspective on like, what are the right decisions around retirement age, spending, saving, all that.
Yeah, I got to give a shout out to your paper on that topic, on liability-driven investing for individual investors. Fantastic paper. Such a good way to think about, well, basically what you just said, trying to model liability matching for households is just like, it's kind of crazy.
I think it's a useful exercise to think about, right? It's useful. No one saves in their 401k because it's fun. I'm not like, oh, like I'm going to sock away 20% a year because it's fun to not spend money today. You do it to fund a goal, right? And so I think like the aspects of that goal should fundamentally drive the portfolio, especially as you get closer to that goal, right? The problem is like a lot of famous economists have like these models that say, oh, retirees should invest all of their money in like inflation adjusted annuities. Well, you can't even buy those, right? Or you should buy TIPS. Well, like it all assumes that retirement liability is like totally fixed to inflation. Well, it's not. Right. And so like you're assuming that someone would never invest in equities because they're just super conservative. Well, there's a benefit to invest in equities over the long term. You have a higher return. And so most investors don't own all bonds because they say, hey, there's a compromise here. I'm willing to accept some risk for a higher expected return. In retirement, I'm willing to accept some flexibility for not having to put all of my money in cash. And so I think that acknowledging the trade-offs people make in real life, which you can make in a household, you can't make in a pension, can lead to, I guess, a very different perspective on, again, that kind of optimal portfolio definition.
Yeah, yeah. The perfect hedge with tips is such a good example. And it's not just the discretionary expenses like we've been talking about, but you've got work also on how expenditure changes with relative to inflation over time. So you don't necessarily need perfect CPI adjustments for your income.
Right. And so like all these models, you know, like most financial plans today, like they assume the retirement liability increases every year by inflation. Okay. Well, on average, and this is somewhat country specific because there's things like healthcare that kind of wreck the model. Like, you know, most people as they get older, they don't tend to increase their spending by inflation. They just tend to slow down. Right. In the US, there's this interesting effect where I talk about the spending smile. Well, like the latter part of the smile are these few households that have these like massive healthcare expenditures. So like if you run a regression on anything, like outliers can kind of really affect, like the average and the median can differ significantly. Well, like that's what happens later on in life where the average gets pulled back up because you have a few folks that have these big expenditures. But for most people, there's this kind of constant decline in today's dollars versus inflation. So like, let's say that inflation is 3%, they only spend 1.5% more per year. Well, here's the thing. If your public pension benefit is indexed to inflation, which most of them are, it actually reduces the inflationary needs of your portfolio. So the efficacy of things like TIPS or inflation-backed bonds changes when you kind of acknowledge the structure of the liability and how it evolves during retirement.
I know we've got one listener that does think this, so I want to ask you the question. Do you think any of that smile is driven by people running out of money and not being able to spend as much?
Half, yes. And I don't think we have a retirement crisis. We have a retirement savings crisis. Developed countries have, for the most part, a really good public pension system. Old folks aren't living on cat food. Like, you know, things are pretty good. Okay. But even if you look at some of the research, I've done this multiple times, what you find is that, yes, some people are cutting back because they have to. You can put them into groups. You can say, okay, this group, these people have like tons of money. Like they have too much money. Okay. Like, you know, how does their spending evolve versus say the folks that don't have any money? Okay. People that have no money, they cut theirs a lot faster. But even the people who have tons of money, they still tend to cut, right? Especially as you move past like 70, 75. And I mean, I would say that anecdotally, like I see this with myself, with my grandparents. I mean, sure, there are going to be some folks that want to go out and stay active, but I think a lot of people just don't want to do as much as they age. And so I think that's what you're seeing here, which is just that people don't tend to increase their full-on spending by inflation every year.
How did you set up your dynamic spending rule in your recent work on this stuff?
So I've spent about maybe 10 or 15 years looking at dynamic spending rules. And here's the thing. So the vast majority of research out there, great research, it would never actually work in a financial planning software. Okay. And there's two key reasons here. Okay. One, there's like dynamic programming, which is like really cool. It like solves every possible state and tells you the answer. Well, that stuff can take like 5 minutes to do a financial plan. And let me tell you, in my experience, nothing angers a client more than you pressing a button and you say, oh, just wait 5 minutes. And then you get like the bad answer. And then, oh, I'm going to change this assumption. We're going to wait 5 more minutes. Like that's not going to work. You need to have like, to me, it's like 5 seconds or less. Okay. So that's why I think like the most robust way won't work today. It might when we get to quantum computing, but right now, not a viable solution. There's lots of rules that exist. Okay. Problem with the rules is they're usually based upon a portfolio that exists with no uneven cash flows. Okay. So what happens if you retire at 60, you claim your public pension at 65, your wife retires at 70, you have a deferred income annuity that kicks in at 85. Okay. That'll break the vast majority of existing dynamic rules to figure out safe withdrawals. Okay. So what you have to do to actually have this work in a financial planning software is to have a line of sight into all assets and liabilities, all income coming in and all outflows going out across the entire length of retirement. And how you can do that is a metric called the funded ratio. Okay. It's really common in pension plans. It's just, you know, the assets, so like your portfolio, net present value of other inflows, like public pension benefits, whatever, over all your spending goal. Okay. And the idea is that you estimate that within like a Monte Carlo projection every year of every run. And based upon that value is how you would adjust the previous year's spending goal. So for example, in the first year of retirement, the goal is based upon the individual, the retiree, but then how that changes in the model over time would depend upon how that funded ratio evolves as you move through retirement. So if the funded ratio is high or increases, you can spend more. If it goes down, you'd spend less. And I totally acknowledge that life comes at you fast, you know what's going to happen. But I think like the goal there is just to say, hey, you're probably going to make changes over time based upon how things go. This is a way to model that and then give you context around the possible distributions of outcome, right? So a static model, you have like all your goal, then you fail. It just waterfalls off to nothing. This is like a tulip, right? Where you show like a distribution of income levels over time. which is, I think, a better conversation than just assuming that, like, you know, oh, you're not going to make a change if your portfolio is going to zero.
Yeah, I love that. Well, why do you think we haven't seen more dynamic spending rules in, I mean, you touched on it just now, it's hard to do, but I mean, there are smart people working on these softwares. Why do you think we don't see it in?
I don't know. Like, we have, in my experience, seen a large pivot towards advisors using Monte Carlo type tools. So like, I would argue there's like deterministic tools where you just have like a single run, a single assumed growth rate. You know, that's probably, when I do surveys, less than 20% of advisors, right? And I would argue that probably like those are like the tiny advisors, like the big advisors that are doing like with bigger clients, a lot of them are doing some kind of like Monte Carlo stochastic analysis. And so I think that these companies are in the business of building better tools, but this isn't things that advisors have ever been like demanding. They don't know how this stuff works. I mean, you know, like they want to talk about their 78% success rate. And I think that that's absurd. Like, you shouldn't tell a client a success rate. Why? Like, that doesn't help them make better choices. But advisors want to quantify this stuff. So like, I'm going to be on the soapbox, like yelling for the next few years, but like, it's the people that build these tools that need to build better tools. Advisors are not going to be built like software engineers. Some are, more props to you. But I think what we need is just a greater awareness of some of the key pitfalls in the existing tools and solutions, and then have the giants in this business build these. And I know that some are. I know that some are already doing this. And I think the good news, hopefully, is those that do it early get market share. It then results in other tools that exist to acknowledge this is important and figure out how to do it. Like, this isn't like top secret. If you read the paper, I've literally walked through step by step exactly how you can do it in a way that I know for certain can be done very quickly in a Monte Carlo projection, and it can give you useful outputs. And so I think what we're previously, well, how would you do this? Like, how do you actually figure out how to make the adjustments that works in the context of projection? There are questions there. I'm sure there's other ways to do it. And I am certain that if you use the process I lay out, you can do it using existing tools.
The demand side is huge, though. There are a lot of advisors that are still not using, in Canada at least, that are still not using Monte Carlo even.
Conferences are very biased, right? You know, people that go to conferences are like the best. Like, even when we do like, we've done surveys within PGMI where I work, and we get about 80% of advisors that answer the surveys consistently using Monte Carlo. So I think it really has kind of caught on as the framework to do financial plans. And I just did a piece that came out recently in Advisor Perspectives. And some advisors get all like bent out of shape about Monte Carlo because they're like, oh, it requires normal return distributions or it uses historical returns. I'm like, no, like there's actually nothing inherent in Monte Carlo, like whatsoever. It literally just means you have something that's random in your projection. Like the rest of it is totally up to you. And so I think what I want to, you know, what I try to like correct people on that kind of throw shade on the idea is like, your tool might be crappy. You might have a crappy calculator. That doesn't mean that all calculators are bad. Right? What you need is a better calculator. Right. I think that like advisors don't understand the fact that, you know, like, yes, we've built all the models in a similar way, but there's actually like infinite ways to do them. And so I think like the goal here, right, is that we just have tools that offer a more robust modeling environment than exist right now.
You talked earlier when we started this segment about the binary outcome that Monte Carlo gives you, that it's like success or fail. How do you describe the utility metric that you use in this paper to evaluate retirement alternatives?
So, you know, again, like Monte Carlo, it doesn't have to be binary. So like success rates are binary, right? Success is either you do or you don't, right? Ones and zeros, okay? Academics who do research in retirement, the good ones, don't use success rates as their outcomes metric. They only think about like the full continuum of what it means to accomplish a goal, right? It's not a one or a zero. It's like a 0.9 or a 0.7 or a 0.6 or a 0.5 or a 1.3. So like just real simply, you know, as opposed to saying like, did I accomplish my goal one or zero? I could say, well, what percentage of my goal did I accomplish? Okay. And that would be between, let's just say zero and one. Let's say you can't overfund a goal. So I got 90% of my goal. Okay. So that's, you know, all of a sudden that's a full curve. It goes to zero to one. It's not just ones and zeros. Okay. On top of that, you could like further adjust the numbers. You could say, well, if it's 0.9, I'm okay with that. But if it's 0.3, I'm going to get really, really angry. So I'm going to make that like a 0.1. Okay. And then the key is how you aggregate them. And so, you know, I talk about this and the guy's like, David, like, this is so complicated. Like advisors want to say this. I don't think they should. I don't think that as an industry, we should be showing clients numbers about outcomes in 50-year projections, right? All you're trying to tell someone is, are you in like really bad shape? Are you in bad shape? Are you in pretty good shape or really good shape? Like, I'm not going to name the company, but the company had a 100,000 Monte Carlo simulation. I'm like, what are you doing? Maybe it sounds cool, but like, you're not helping anyone with that kind of model. Like, and they were even using historical returns. I'm like, this is absurd. Like, you're doing 100,000 runs with purely historical long-term averages. What's the point of that? I think the key should be relaying information in a way that individuals can understand it. And, you know, so I like complicated models behind the scenes that do dynamic withdrawals, but I like, I don't know if it's like bunnies or like a thermometer gauge or whatever else it is, but like you're in terrible shape, you're in great shape. And that's really about all we can tell you. And so I think what's really important here is that, yes, this stuff sounds complex. And I'm a fan of building things that I think better reflect reality, but how you communicate that to clients or advisors could be very different than the math behind the scenes.
Bunny planning. There's a business plan.
And a bunny is like, there's like, you can do clouds. There's all, and so like the group, I give them my input and they ignore me. So we're thinking about like how you do that. And it's, my key is it's not a number. You know, I don't think telling someone that there's a 90% success rate really helps them make better choices. Because in reality, they're in really good shape. If you have a 90% success rate, that means like in this model, assuming good assumptions, you never have to make a change to your goal once. And then when you fail, you probably only fail by a tiny bit. But then because it's only 90, do they get nervous? Well, my God, what happens if I fail? I'm talking about like failures in Monte Carlo are not plane crashes. Certain individuals who remain nameless have been like, you can't trust a financial plan because you don't want to get on an airplane. It's going to fail 10% of the time. That's absurd. That's not what a failure in Monte Carlo means. But clients don't understand that. That's why I worry like, you know, oh, some advisors are like a badge of honor. My clients have 98% success rates. I'm like, that's ridiculous. Like your clients aren't enjoying their lives because you're targeting like a crazy high success rate. So I think that if you take the numbers out of it, at least out of the outcome, I think that could help advisors and retirees, households make better choices.
Nobody wants to see a bunny failure.
That's right. Like a bunny on a plane crashing, that would just be terrible, right?
Terrible. So how do first-year safe withdrawal rates change when you incorporate needs and wants and dynamic spending and utility as opposed to static spending?
Again, unequivocally, like they go up. So think about like a static goal with success rates, ones and zeros. I think where we're going to get into trouble and why now is more important is there has been a greater awareness among advisors that you have to plan for retirements that last 30 plus years, 30, 35 years, okay? And when you do static projections and you assume retirement lasts 35 years, when the person fails, it's like in the 34th year of retirement, when they're like 99 and they fail by this much. Okay. So, you know, capturing the fact that, oh, okay, maybe they're going to fail eventually, but only by this much. What it tends to do pretty unequivocally is give someone the ability to spend more today, right? You're taking the handcuffs off of like, oh, it's just ones and zeros. It's no longer ones and zeros. It's like ones and 0.99s. Right. So you tend to see more aggressive portfolios than you would get using traditional LDI. You tend to see higher withdrawal rates. One thing that's kind of interesting is there is actually some ambiguity around allocations to guaranteed income like annuities. What you tend to see in these models is that it's really valuable to fund their essential expenditures. But beyond that, it's a lot more dealer's choice. Right. And so people out there saying like, you know, retirees all need more annuities. Well, how are they going to feel about a shortfall? What is their capacity to adjust? I think having the essential expenditures covered is really important. But beyond that, that's more of a, you know, how do you feel about creating income and everything else?
That's kind of crazy. So you could have a model specified to output a large annuity allocation. Is that kind of what you're saying? Where if you modeled preferences a certain way?
So like, let's just think about like a more traditional immediate income annuity. Okay, nominal. You give money to the insurance company. They pay you $7,000 a year for life. The problem with that in a Monte Carlo projection is that it tends to lead to like, it's like a tipping point where it, based upon your assumptions, it makes it look really good or really bad, okay? Mm-hmm. And so if you have like conservative CMAs and long retirement, like, you know, oh, it dominates. I should own all of this. And so I think like the key is annuities, they can improve outcomes, right? But it's understanding what most important thing is, what is the goal? The goal is to have income for life. Well, like one, do you need it? What are your existing sources of guaranteed income? Like the problem with success rates, you could have a 0% success rate, be on track to replace 98% of your goal. You could have all of your needs, almost all your wants covered because your portfolio, that tiny piece, that's all success rates measure is what is your portfolio doing versus your goal, right? And so I think what that gives is this wrong context about like, you know, oh, successful, unsuccessful. No, it's like you think about how you're doing more holistically, again, like static withdrawals, success rates. I don't think it gives advisors that correct picture.
Okay, to come back to Monte Carlo or traditional Monte Carlo, the way that it's generally used by financial advisors. How would a financial plan optimized for utility, as we've been talking about with split out expenses for elastic and inelastic, if we optimize a plan in that framework, how would it look if we went back and evaluated it with a traditional typical framework?
Yeah. So again, like what you would tend to see. So like if you're doing like a solver, right? And you said, okay, well, like how do things look? You'll typically get higher or much higher safe withdrawal rates if you incorporate flexibility. and utility. We tend to get a little bit more aggressive portfolios, right? Because again, it's about trade-offs, right? Life is all about trade-offs. Like that's what it is. And so I think that a lot of the more traditional LDI focused models are all about conservatism, and you want to have strong guaranteed annual returns. Well, I want to invest in equities if it means that there's a chance I can go on more vacations, right? If I'm kind of rolling the dice there. But then also it's to me like the biggest thing is the role of guaranteed income and do people need more? If you use static assumptions in a base utility model, which is actually really common in the research, it just says everyone needs more annuities. Like that is like the takeaway that you hear all the time. Like academics, you know, like, oh, more annuities. I like guaranteed lifetime income, just to be clear. But the problem with that is that it's doing that whole static failure thing. It's like, oh, you're going to go from like all your gold to none of it. But if you glide down slowly, it really changes how efficient an outcome is. And so when you evolve a plan from static to dynamic, and you overlay utility, you get very different results than if you can just assume those static withdrawals.
Okay, that's super interesting. So we know empirically, like you talked about earlier, that people do spend dynamically, or they do have flexibility in their spending. Could that help explain the so-called annuity puzzle?
I think it explains part of it, right? I think that annuities are sold, not bought. Some are complicated. Some make a lot of sense. A lot of them have high commissions, high fees, they're opaque. There's all these problems. I think that if you take a step back, and we could all agree retirement is incredibly complicated, like the shift towards idiosyncratic longevity risk is not good for retirees, you have to manage it, right? And so I think that, you know, there's lots of reasons that people talk about why individuals don't allocate more to annuities. I think that we're seeing products that offer revocability, that offer cash refund provisions. We're kind of slowly moving away from these things that individuals clearly desire. But I think there's this larger question of like, what am I guaranteeing? If I have a super strong preference for going golfing every day forever and doing all these different things, then by definition, I should value an annuity if I don't have that already. But people already have a lot of public pension benefits, right? They already have Social Security. They might have other forms of guaranteed income. And so I think to your point, it does suggest part of the reason why individuals don't annuitize more is because they like the liquidity, the freedom, the flexibility of having a portfolio to fund those more flexible expenses, especially once they have those essential expenses covered for life.
Wow. Where does this research go next?
I just hope people build more tools. I mean, like we're working on a tool that kind of does this within PGIM. You know, there's other companies that do this that I think can do it. To me, like the most important thing here is a more realistic framework to give people advice and guidance. And again, Monte Carlo, 50 years, hot mess of stuff that's going to go wrong. But assuming that someone's going to make a change if they have to, you're not going to be giving them good advice out of the gate. And so to me, I think that a lot of this is, you know, like the earlier regret. It's helping individuals achieve better financial outcomes across a variety of definitions of what it means to kind of achieve a goal. It's not just variance, it's regret and variance. With respect to like this research around static dynamic withdrawals, it's just a more realistic financial plan. And in reality, what it should do, hopefully we can communicate outcomes better to clients and we can actually make them more comfortable depleting their assets and using their portfolio to fund spending earlier in retirement.
Super interesting. Okay, we got a couple more papers we want to ask about. Total change of topic, but they're just so good. I didn't want to leave them out. You did some survey-based research on how advisor channel affects passive fund choice. Can you talk about that research?
I have a few things that are related to this topic of how advisors are registered and how they're compensated, and to the extent that it might affect decisions that they make with respect to clients, right? At the end of the day, I don't know that I have like super strong theoretical preferences to how an advisor gets paid, you know, fee, commission, whatever, as long as it's fully disclosed and transparent. Okay. Where it becomes an issue though, is when there's research that suggests that advisors that are paid one way or do things another way, perhaps create better outcomes on average for their clients, where there's more kind of, okay, yeah, you're going to get paid, but like, you know, does it affect your decision-making? And so you can look at the selection of funds. I have another piece that's under review at a journal right now, looking at how equity allocations vary over time. So like, you know, based upon commission codes. So there's A, B, C, D commission codes, you know, do advisors who get paid more upfront, do they exhibit more time varying risk aversion than they do? And so I think that to me, what this larger body of research is saying is that, you know, again, theoretically, people get paid different ways, like, okay, but there is growing evidence that how they're paid might affect their decisions and not always in the best interest of their clients. So I think like that to me is the key behind this is that in theory, it shouldn't matter, but in reality, it does appear to matter.
How do you think clients should use this information?
So the problem is that I don't know that clients can really figure out if an advisor is doing a good or bad job, right? Like it's so hard to know. There's a fancy term that I'm forgetting about the type of good that advice is, where you don't know even afterwards if they did a good job, right? So I think that you look for the positive signals, like are they a certified financial planner, right? You know, like are they transparent in their fees? But even then, I mean, just to be honest, like if I were like a crook, right, I would want to get a CFP because it would make me seem like I'm less of a crook, right? So like, I mean, we can't just say that like, oh, CFPs are all great, because I would have an incentive to literally get one because it creates a halo effect. But by definition, if you have a CFP, you have taken some tests that are difficult. You have minimum education requirements. You know, you should have relatively a clean regulatory history. So I think that there are things that households should be doing that are kind of filtering out all advisors into those that at least appear to be more professional than just you meet someone at a cocktail party and they're your guy. I wouldn't recommend that. I think you should need to do due diligence and understand what are the person's qualifications, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we just did an episode on what are the measurable benefits of financial advice. And we talked a lot about that. That's why I had the Credence Good word in my head.
There you go. So you got it.
Yeah. There's a bunch of literature like you're talking about on how commission-based advice tends to be really not so good. So I think that compensation piece seems to be all the education stuff, totally agree. But that compensation piece seems to be a pretty clear filter, at least as a baseline.
To me, like the one nuance there is I'm not convinced that commissions themselves are the problem. It's the individuals who tend to sell things that are commission-based. I mean, it's like a nuance there where like, because fees, if you do AUM, in any model that you can create, there's going to be negative incentives. But I think that at least structurally, the quality of advisors that are paid based upon commission are lower quality on average than those that are paid based upon assets under management, right? And so I think that, you know, like, so yes, you could say, well, then we should ban commissions. Well, like, then if it's the same advisors, they'll just find a new way to do things that aren't as good with AUM. So, you know, to me, there's this question of, is there like a signaling thing there where, you know, it's really not just the fact that how they're paid, it's because they're just not as good, you know, CFPs versus non-CFPs. So I think that this is all really difficult to figure out until like after the fact, you know, like, did they actually do a good job? But I think that our profession has evolved a lot, right? You know, I did internships in this business 20 years ago. Oh, you're a stockbroker? I mean, I guess like that's what you do. You just buy and sell stocks, right? But we're evolving. Like there's higher standards. And so I think that it's all good, but there's still a lot of folks in this industry that don't do things that I think are always in the client's best interest.
Yeah. One more big pivot in terms of topics. You had another paper on foreign revenue. How important is the country that equities derive their revenue from as opposed to their country of domicile in explaining returns?
It depends. Another like quality depends. You know, so I think what sparked this particular piece of research was actually a new data point in Morningstar Direct. This is actually when I was at Morningstar. I started working on this. That provide information on the percentage of revenue from a given index or fund from different countries, right? Because, I mean, domicile is binary, right? You assign a company to a country and how that is determined, it could be totally like for tax reasons or something else. Like there's just, you know, like it's not like you weight companies across different countries. You usually put them in a single domicile. And I think there's this question of, well, like, you know, does that accurately capture the true global risk of a company? And the answer is it's obviously no, right? I mean, usually smaller companies have most of the revenue domestically, but as you get larger, you can have a larger and larger share that's international. And so I think that there's been other folks that have kind of analyzed this, but I think, do we need to, as our society becomes increasingly global, think about different ways to construct indexes or portfolios, given the vastly different revenue profiles that exist across countries that in these indices and across countries. And so I think that to me, like I mean, that was the point, is just that there clears to be a huge effect, you know, possibly larger than domicile in terms of what drives the returns of a given index based upon location, right? And I forget some of the stats in the piece, but, you know, certain countries have most of their revenue from their, you know, their largest companies come from globally. Well, you know, if we go way back to like LDI for individual portfolios, what you would kind of want is if I live in the UK, I would probably want to own stocks that kind of track the UK market pretty well. Like if inflation takes off and prices go higher, they do well. Well, if all the revenue from the companies in the UK come from Europe and China or just whatever else, then that doesn't help me as much. So I think that there's ways you could think about building portfolios of securities, whatever else, that help better kind of track what you're trying to do with a given strategy that you would not capture necessarily at all in domicile.
Yeah, that's super interesting. That's one of the home country bias arguments that it can be sensible for the reason you just said, to hedge local consumption. But you're saying you can't just do that with a local index. You have to do it with the revenues from local companies, which could be totally different from the local index.
Right. I mean, it tends to kind of all wash out, right? You tend to see like some are very local, some are global. But if you really wanted to do that, you could. I mean, like, I think MSCI like walked down this path a decade ago. I don't think they did anything with it. But like, you really could create local focused indices that would give, I think, especially like retirees, a better exposure to, you know, to the equity market, their local equity, right?
There's two pieces, right? There's the discount rate side and the cash flow side. So for long-term investors, you might be affected by foreign discount rates if you own foreign companies that derive most of their revenue from the UK in that example. So you're affected to foreign discount rates, but in the long run, the cash flow side is more driven by the local UK stuff, which is maybe what you care more about, at least in the example of someone wanting to hedge local consumption. Super interesting.
Does this finding dramatically change people's home country bias if you look around the world? Do you know?
Not really. I mean, so like small cap companies are really still mostly domestic, like US especially, right? And I think this is, and it has been, a larger issue for smaller countries that don't have as large of a global footprint as the US. But that's just always been how it is. And so then I try to like build a diversified portfolio doing that. And it's kind of tough because, you know, like certain industries, everyone in the industry is global. So I think that to me, there's just this question, like, again, as we move forward in the future and we have this increasingly connected global economy, in theory, like domicile just becomes more and more meaningless as a metric, considering other metrics could yield a very different perspective on like the global risks, for example, of an index. Even if you're not doing like any kind of like beta decomposition, like you're not doing RBSA and all that, you might just say, oh, well, this is a US large cap fund. Well, yes, all the companies are domiciled in the US, but you know, this fund in particular has 60% of the revenues or 80% of the revenues coming from other countries. So it really is an international exposure with domestic domicile.
Okay. Now that is often used as a reason, particularly by US investors, to not need international diversification. Do you think that this negates the need for international diversification?
To some extent it does, right? So like, and again, I forget the numbers, but like if you own Coca-Cola, that isn't like they're just selling Coke here in the US. All these really large, really, really large Apple, they are truly global companies. And so I think that it does negate the need for owning an explicit sleeved international, right? Because there is significant revenue for most of these companies that is foreign.
Cool. Well, that's the last of our questions, David. This has been fantastic as usual. Thanks a lot for coming back on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, David. Amazing.
Sure, thanks for having me.